Hello, and welcome to The Big Web Show, everything web that matters. I am your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and with me today is a brilliant UX professional, an old friend of mine, an old work colleague of mine. He's now the VP of Design at Capital One and the author of Meeting Design. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm speaking, of course, of Kevin M. Hoffman.
Hey, Jeffrey.
How are you? And I cut your title short. It's Meeting Design for Managers, Makers, and Everyone.
I'll take either one. Either one is 100% accurate. So okay. I will take either. Thank you.
I love meeting design, and I love the different ways that it reads, the different ways you can interpret those two words when they're joined.
Yeah, noun and verb. It didn't even occur to me until somebody on Twitter was like, I thought it was about meeting with designers. And I was like, oh, but it's fine.
No, it's the design of meetings, but it's also about embracing design in your work culture. So you're meeting design. I assumed that was just one of the many clevernesses.
We'll say yes.
We'll say yes. Always take credit. So there's a sales chart and some characters that you've added on your Twitter feed, which is at Kevin M. Hoffman, which is one place people can find you, at Kevin M. Hoffman. You've got the books, like a stack of freshly printed books, which must be a thrill.
Yeah, it's really exciting. I think I first chatted with you about the idea of this book, I want to say at least 7, maybe 8 years ago. And I didn't really start writing until about 3 years ago, but it's always been kind of an idea in my head back when we were working together, and as I've joined you at your conference and in other ways. So it's really exciting to have it out.
We were both at HappyCog, and we would go to meetings, and you were just brilliant in meetings. And
oh, that's really sweet of you to say. Thank you.
That's a really important skill. So there's things people do collaboratively. There's things people do privately that are, I'm sorry, there's lots of things that, what I mean is in work.
We all do
In the work that we do, sometimes like somebody's going to go off and code something, or I've got to sit down and write this thing. I've just got to wrestle with it, or I've really got to design this logo. And it's kind of temporarily a private thing someone goes off and does. And then, but there's this other very important and increasingly important, right? Because web design and product design, they've gotten very complicated. The organizations are bigger. The user experience is much more complex than what we used to. We used to basically make pictures and then put a button in the middle of it, and we were kind of done. And now there's this, right? Mike Essel says, you know, design, you know, digital design, it's a machine. It's not a picture, it's a machine, right?
It's not even, I mean, it's a machine. It's also a scalable machine. So
yeah, and it's a different machine for different people who use it.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's very complicated, which means we're going to be in meetings. We're going to be collaborating. And most of us hate meetings.
And you, I think so.
And you always thrived there. I was always glad to have you in the meeting. I always felt like that's someone you want in the room. If I'm going to be meeting with, whether they're very experienced people or, you know, scary people, inexperienced, but whatever it is, that you would have this way of making everyone feel comfortable and listened to, and you would organize the chaos. Because a lot of times, I mean, bad meetings, we've all been to them, right?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, like, what are your 5 favorite bad meeting types?
5 favorite bad meeting types? I'm with you. I would say, well, so if I think about bad meetings, I feel like there's 2 basic genres of bad meetings. Ones are meetings that we expect to be bad. So meetings, for whatever reason, that we've gone in with the expectation that things are going to go wrong. It might be a difficult topic. We might not have a lot of confidence in the other people in the room. We might be expecting big personal agendas, and you know, we almost go in expecting a battle. And then there are the other category of meetings that go wrong are meetings that we don't expect to go wrong, but just something goes off the rails. So if I think about, I mean, honestly, anything, but let's just stay in the world of design. If I think about design and designing a good thing, like, let's just say a good website, there are two kinds of mistakes people make. There are mistakes people make where we present them with a difficult task and we hope that it's usable, but it turns out not to be quite usable and we need to fine tune it. And then there are experiences we design where we think it's simple. It's, you know, one button and it's like, okay, cancel. And you need to just hit that button. But for whatever reason, you know, something about the design that we didn't anticipate goes wrong. And I think,
like the words, okay, cancel.
Yeah.
Right. Which exactly. Are shorthand for it made sense to the developer, but right. it's completely bad. I mean, still to this day, it's mostly in Windows, but still to this day, there are apps and things where it's like, are you sure you want to cancel? Yeah. Okay, or cancel. And cancel means cancel the canceling. Don't cancel. Right. And okay means, yes, I agree, I do want to cancel. But since the word cancel seems more like what you wanted to do, and the word okay, anyway, I don't have everyone listening.
No,
to
I'm
this,
with you. It's anyone listening like to this has cancel had, and really cancel would be better and worse at the same time.
There's got to be another way to do it, but we have these weird anti patterns we get stuck with where other people are doing it that way, so we do it that way.
And that's like with meetings, my hypothesis and what I've seen in my career and what I've seen in the research for the book. Is that what you just said? We have these patterns that we pick up from somewhere, usually our first job or our first couple of jobs, depending on how many jobs you have. I've had a bunch over the years. And you pick up these patterns and you think that's what meetings are. So I'm the person I wrote the book for is the first person I wrote it for is me about 25 years ago. About 25 years ago, I was getting out of school. I went to work in a public library system. I would have meetings with, the directors of the library. I would have meetings with community folks. I would have meetings with other librarians. And I just didn't know, like, what all these things meant. I assumed that's how meetings were done based on those experiences.
Sure.
Then I went and worked in higher ed, and it was a little different. It was kind of the same, but it was a little different. And then I went and worked at an agency with you. And it was very different. And you know, over time, I started to realize that, you know, all of us, we're all doing the same thing. We're all kind of carrying these presumptions about how to meet based on our past into where we currently are, into the room we're in. And I just wanted to think about, okay, what is a book that would help me, first of all, understand that? And second, kind of design around that as a constraint.
I think what you're talking about, it's almost like the journey, not to get too heavy, but like we're on Earth where things happen early on that shape us. And then we have this journey where we kind of get out of some of those patterns. So, for instance, someone's abused in childhood, then they keep falling in love with new people and they think this will be the one. But it's an abusive relationship. They're hurt again. They go,
because bizarrely, that abuse feels like safety.
Yes,
in some way, because it reminds them of a period in their life where they needed to feel safe because they were defenseless as a child. And I think, and I'm totally fine.
It's a good example.
I think it's more interesting that way.
It's actually a good example of bad meetings.
And the trick really is for that person or for anyone. Understanding that you have a bias that is deeply rooted in your unconscious and that you can't control that bias, but what you can do is try to observe it and learn to course correct it as it happens, you know, learn from each iterative experience. And that's the thing, you know, not to talk too much about the book, but in the book,
let's talk about the book.
I like the metaphors. I think it's actually fun.
But it's interesting, too, because this happens on two levels. So on one level, a person reading the book can go, oh, here's this thing I always do in meetings. I always assume they're going to suck. And they do. and there's something different that I can do. But there's also an organization, right? The culture has to change too.
Yeah.
It's like if all the people, like imagine a place where all the people are woke, but the culture's racist. So all the people, sitting there are like, I don't want to be racist. I don't want to be racist. But the company makes racist products. Like that's not going to work.
Yeah, I think you see that in a lot of cultures. I don't want to say big business cultures, but definitely.
It's hard to avoid in bigger businesses. It's really hard to avoid.
The thing you see culturally that I find, and it's been discussed a lot recently. It came up on Twitter in some conversations I was in, but the fact that it's pretty statistically provable that women are interrupted at a rate far exceeding the way anyone else is interrupted in conversations. Mm-hmm. And that is a cultural constraint. And if you're new in a job and you go into meetings and you see that happening, that tells you something about that culture. And then the question is, what do you do with that data point? You know, are you somebody who, you know, are you ideally you want to change the data, you want to change that culture, that aspect of the culture anyway. So how do you go about doing that? And one thing I think, I talk about this in chapter 6, but I do think that meetings, the relationship between the meetings an organization has, both the rituals, the regular meetings, and the way they use meetings to tackle problems that arise and to kind of swarm on like a priority, being able to observe that tells you a lot about the culture if you're new. It allows you to be successful in the culture if you pay attention. And ultimately, it allows you to change the culture if you need to. But you have to think of it as an iterative process like design, where it's like the first logo you design or the first stab at the navigation isn't going to be the right one. You know. So as you're in meeting after meeting, you're trying to hack some aspect of the culture, understand it, maybe tweak it, and ultimately change it. You know, it's not going to be like you could be in a meeting and say, hey, everybody, you know what we do too much? We don't listen. We just talk over each other too much. So let's not do that. And everybody's going to be like, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And then you'll be in the next meeting and it happens again. What you have to do is think about, well, how could we design that out of the conversation? What if we were forced to write before we spoke? And what if we were limited in terms of how much we could write? What if someone had to write the conversation in real time on the wall? You know, would we be focusing on the wall and less on interrupting each other? I think thinking about what can we actually introduce as a design choice into a conversation that will either reveal the cultural problem, really point it out in a different way, in a way that has a deeper meaning, or slowly design it out of the way that we talk to each other.
I love that, but here's my question.
Yeah.
What you're describing, what can we introduce as a design choice to reveal the cultural problem or slowly design it out of our culture? Mm-hmm. Now, that's something that, say, like you're a vice president, right? You're a VP of design. That's something that you can do. But you 25 years ago, you starting your career, a woman who gets talked over, a woman 22 years old, brilliant, full of great ideas, but being disrespected for like multiple reasons, what can that person do? Can she interrupt and say, hey, folks, you're interrupting me, and you're also interrupting Gladys here, and I think it's, I mean, what can the person with less authority do to design a better meeting outcome?
So there's two things I want to say about that, two things that come to mind. One, I don't think I'm in a position to give advice about a problem that I don't experience. So I definitely don't want to. I don't want this to come across as, if you're a young woman and you're new in the field and you're getting interrupted, I could tell you what to do.
No,
I think ultimately the thing that you have to do is the thing that feels authentic to you that allows you to find empowerment. Now,
thank you for saying that.
But, yeah, that being
the more general thing.
The more general hierarchy, dealing with hierarchy.
I'm a junior person. Yeah. I observe and see this dysfunction.
Yeah. So one thing that comes to mind is that, yes, my title, it happens to be vice president, and I'm one of several vice presidents at a company. The design organization is 400 people. No, 450, I think now.
Wow.
And the company itself is more than 50,000 people.
Right.
So I'm a vice president, but if you look at the org chart, I sit kind of in the middle. So there's always somebody above you. And even if you're the CEO, there's still really people above you, you know, mm-hmm. in a sense. That being said,
the shareholders.
The shareholders. If you want to go beyond that, you're getting outside of the organization. Who are the shareholders beholden to?
Right.
You know, like you can keep going. But let's just talk about the sense of powerlessness, or the sense of that you don't have agency in a meeting experience that that you are a part of and expected to deliver in.
So before you, I will say this.
Yeah.
In some of the, I have several companies and several activities that I do. In some of the activities that I do, even though I actually have authority on paper,
mm-hmm.
because of my own quirks and my own comfort level with confrontation, I will often, in some meetings, I'll sit there and feel this is not a productive meeting.
Yep.
I'm just waiting for this to be over. But I don't want to, I can't hurt this person's feelings, or there's this dynamic between these two people and it's like a wall.
Yeah. So
I mean, you don't have to be the junior person to feel like the meeting isn't working for you.
Yeah. No, not at all. I spoke with Jeff Veen on a podcast recently. And Jeff is in the venture capital business. He regularly meets with very powerful boards. When he was at Adobe, he would meet with the Adobe board often. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was in situations where he had a lot of pressure and was expected to, essentially, I would say he would agree he was the junior person in the room, even as the founder of Typekit.
Of Typekit, right.
You know, and certainly the lead of Typekit within Adobe.
He was with people older than him who commanded a company that was worth many millions more than his little Typekit. But they knew that he was the future,
yeah,
and that they had to bring the culture he represented into their culture.
So,
but he was beholden to them.
Yes.
As the sort of the grandparents of the thing.
Yeah. So let's take the power differential and let's abstract it. So it could be a product lead talking to a board. It could be a vice president talking to senior vice presidents. It could be a junior designer just out of their MFA program talking to a creative director. Doesn't matter. The one thing that I've heard, and this is something I've talked about before, but it's something that Jeff Veen brought up today when I did his podcast, or recorded his podcast. He brought it up in a way that I've never heard before, which I think is really powerful to think about. So Jeff is a designer, or certainly, I think we're all designers in a sense, and Jeff mm-hmm. certainly has years of experience working within mm-hmm. design.
He's a product designer.
Yeah. And Jeff said, the one thing he would always do when he would go into a room like that where he felt that power differential is before he sat down, he would go over to the whiteboard and grab a marker, and that would be his security blanket. And if he got into a situation where, let's say, like you said earlier, those two people are having kind of they're in a tangle, they're having a conversation that is kind of driving the tone of the meeting, and if you have conflict aversion, it's making you uncomfortable, by going up and starting to write down or sketch out visually what he was hearing, it allowed people, it draws the attention away from what we perceive as real. So I'm talking to you right now. We're talking about meetings. We're talking about our biases. We're talking about all these things. If we added a visual component to this conversation, whatever that looks like, it's going to draw both of our attention to a thing that is not a person. And the person with the marker that's creating that thing becomes kind of a channel for us to create a narrative together. And ultimately, that's what's happening in meetings, whether you capture it or not. You're creating a narrative about how you've created more or less alignment on whatever it is that you're working on for the time that you're having that conversation, or you're doing that workshop, or whatever it is that you're doing. by having a real-time visual record of that, you have kind of this wonderful feedback loop that happens. And if you're in a position where you feel powerless, where you feel like you can't make a difference, just getting up and tracking the main ideas and maybe even sketching out your thoughts is a very powerful equalizer. And it's a way to provide value in a room where you may not be contributing ideas, but if somebody says, and I've said this in talks, but if somebody says, hey, what are you doing? You just say, hey, I'm writing this down to help me understand the conversation. I'm just writing it on the wall so I can make sense out of it. It helps me, you know, it helps me learn. Yeah. But really what you're doing is you're helping the whole room kind of create this loop between what they see and what they hear. Because if you go by what you hear, then you're relying on your memory exclusively. And your memory is very short and it's very biased. Like, you're going to walk into the room wanting certain things to happen in the meeting, and the things I want to happen and the things you want to happen are going to be very different. There's going to be a Venn diagram of overlap, but ultimately it's not going to be identical. And the visual is where hopefully it starts to represent all of our overlap. Does that make sense?
That is such a brilliant hack. I've seen it done. I've seen, I have a client right now, and the creative director, kickoff meeting, first thing he did, grabbed the marker. In a way, even though, and he was working with all C-level executives. Yeah. And he's a vice president, but they're all C-level executives. And they're all really powerful and opinionated and maybe have very different points of view.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, you're providing value, like you said. It gives you a sense of self-control and power.
Yeah.
So you don't feel powerless. It gives you control of the narrative to some extent, and people don't never realize that. It's almost like I was just on jury duty. The court reporter, if the court reporter was a bit of an editor,
yeah,
they're not. They have to just transcribe everything. But imagine you're kind of a court reporter who gets to edit out the things a little bit.
Yeah.
You think are unproductive. You totally control.
You're in control of truth.
I think this thing after meetings whenever I can, where I write the meeting notes. And I write the meeting notes after a high-level meeting with my client because it gives me a chance to make sense of what happened. I take like really long, detailed notes all through the conversation.
Yeah.
I don't ever want to be in a position where I'm so important someone else takes the notes. I'm glad other people take the notes because we need to compare, and I always want to see everyone's notes, but I always take my own notes. And then I look at it. Maybe if I'm confused on a point, I'll talk with other people who were in the room. What about this? What about that? But then I write up the notes because that becomes a way to start becoming strategic, to start presenting a point of view. And it's not just this amorphous opinion thing, like a bunch of opinions in a room that didn't go anywhere. It starts to be, if you heard some consensus building or if there was a testable assertion, then you focus on the testable assertion and you sort of bring it up to a next step level prominence.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. There's one thing that I want to point out about that practice. So, you know, you talked about your own personal notes that you take in conversations, and I do that too. Like, I will, when I have one-on-one meetings or when I have, you know, big group meetings, I will often take notes, even if there's someone else taking notes in an official capacity or there's someone capturing stuff on the whiteboard. But the real important thing that I think I would hope people learn from the book, and that I wanted to tell my 23-year-old or 24-year-old self, is the person writing on the whiteboard or sketching on the whiteboard and the notes you take, so they serve different purposes. And don't assume that one replaces the other. Like, don't assume that if you're taking really good notes, you're a typist, you can transcribe people's words in real time. Don't assume that there isn't a wholly different value by actually doing it in a visual way.
Absolutely.
In real time.
Absolutely.
And don't assume that having that visual notes, those real time kind of building the narrative of the conversation visually, whether it's done in sketches or just in words, don't assume that's a real-time transcription because that's filtered through the person making that graphic.
Right.
And that's a point of view. Your notes are a point of view. And the more data points you have, sometimes the better off you are. I think the most important thing to take from either of those, though, is what is the relationship between the conversations and the activities that you had in that meeting and the change that you made as a result of the conversation. And that's the thing that I talk about in chapter one, just a basic question to ask, especially around ceremonial meetings or repeated meetings. How do you measure the change that this meeting is supposed to create? So we're an agile shop. We're capital A agile. We have a stand-up, we have a retrospective, and we have some sort of scoping meeting for each sprint. How do you know that scoping meeting or the retrospective or the stand-up is actually improving the way you're running agile process? The only way you know that is if you're measuring something. So if it's a stand-up, you're probably measuring movement of tasks across a board. Like, this is how much is moving out of the backlog into actively being designed things. And this is how much is moving into done. You know, and you can track that in a meeting. If it's a retrospective, you can measure it in terms of what behaviors are you actually changing sprint by sprint. Are you actually changing the way people are applied to tasks? Are you changing your own personal approaches and to design coming out of that retrospective? Because if you just have retrospectives every week or every 2 weeks, depending on your sprint cadence, if you have a retrospective where you say, you know, what did we do well? Everything. What do we need to change? Nothing. Then right. There's no reason to have that meeting because, number one, you're lying to yourselves. But number two, that meeting isn't adding value. You're spending money on time that doesn't, you know, you're not making any improvements.
Again, the title is Meeting Design. Design, as we know from our friend Jared Spool, is the rendering of intent. All design has to be intentional. One of the things that I'm working on now with my clients is we have all this content. But is there a meaningful intention behind it, and is it moving the needle? And if it's not moving the needle, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So have goals, figure out what your goals are, test them, and mm-hmm. then do things that advance the goals. You could, like you said, you could have a meeting every day where you have a wonderful conversation, and you could have these meetings and go, boy, everyone's so full of stories. I just love that. And there's nothing wrong with that. Stories are great. But if it's not doing something, then it's wasting time. I hate when people say meetings are a waste of time and they just rule them out because many meetings are a waste of time, but we can do something about that. And many other meetings are essential.
Yeah.
And we fail without them.
I think that saying meetings are a waste of time is like saying screwdrivers are a waste of time. If I'm in a okay. if I'm in a room and there's a bunch of nails and I have a screwdriver, of course I'm going to say screwdrivers are a waste of time. But the question is not whether or not the tool is good or bad. It's a tool, right? The question is, how are we using that tool? Are we using it in a precise way? Is it allowing us to have, and forgive the business jargon, but is this tool allowing us to have leverage against a thing?
I knew you were going to say the word leverage.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I knew it was coming.
There's got to be like a bingo card.
That's my favorite.
That's my favorite sort of thing.
I once wrote a commercial about beverage leveraging when I was in advertising. Like that's my favorite. I think it's arrogant. So here's the thing. A lot of meetings are a waste of time because we don't know what we're doing with them, and nobody should be subjected to those. So your book is there to say, here's how to not make them a waste of time. But it bothers me when like a CEO of a startup says, I never do meetings, they're a waste of time, because it's like, well, aren't you lucky? That's a wonderful privilege, and I hope your business survives without them. It's like, well, we don't test. I make all the decisions. And like, okay, and I hope you're Steve Jobs. And I hope that works for you.
And
but for most people, it's not going to work. So we need something more.
In my research, one thing that I learned is I talked to startups, and you would talk to a startup and they would say, they might say something in the flavor of what you said. We don't like meetings. They're a waste of our time. But if you ask them, well, you know, what do you do every day? They have a lot of meetings. They just don't call them meetings. You know, like they might have a lot of informal gatherings where they decide to swarm on a problem in a conversation, but it's not on a calendar, you know, and it might not be an hour. It might be 15 minutes here and a random 20 minutes at the end of the day. But, you know, there is no group of people engaged in a business process that is not meeting in some capacity. They may not be like business meetings. They may not look like business meetings, but they're meeting. You know, I would love somebody to prove to me that they don't have meetings. You know, because there's, I mean, imagine an organization, let's say you have four people who do a startup company, they're building a software product, and they say they never meet. How does that work? How exactly? They're all just working independently. They only talk asynchronously. You know, they only talk via Slack. Nobody is actually responding to each other in real time. There's no way that works, you know?
You know, I think it's mostly the recurring ceremonial meetings that are the problem for many of us. It can be very frustrating if you like meet every morning from 10 to 10:30 with no clear agenda. And the leader turns to each person and says, okay, Bob, what do you got? Sally, what have you got? That's a waste of people's time. That can be frustrating. It's a social meeting. If a room full of Quakers want to do that on Sunday and let, you know, people share their joys and concerns, that's a social thing. That's a positive. But if everybody's just hanging around from 10 to 10:30 trying to come up with something to talk about, that's a waste of everyone's time. And I think there's too many of those kinds of meetings.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing that I think is important to think about it with those kind of rituals that are hanging around is if you're a person who's not in power and you want to make change in those rituals that don't have value for you, the most powerful thing I think you can do is question that ritual. You can say, you know, I don't understand why we have this meeting. You know, if we took it away, we'd still all be doing the same thing. We're not actually changing what we do by having this meeting. So why do we have it? To ask that question is very empowering. When you do it, be prepared to follow up with, here's what I would do instead.
Yes.
Which I think is the thing that you have to learn over time. The thing you want to say is not, hey, we shouldn't be doing this stupid thing. The thing you want to say instead is, we should be doing this awesome thing.
My old boss, he would just say, you bring me problems, bring me solutions.
Yeah.
And that's corny, but it's accurate to just say, what we're doing is stupid and sucks. And this, like, that's like you're 14.
Yeah.
And that's okay, but that's not helping.
That's strike two in our three strikes of business jargon. Strike number one is leverage. Strike number two is you're bringing me problems, bring me solutions.
And now I'm going to do strike three, which is
already.
I got strike three, which is it's time for a sponsor break. I just want to quickly thank our sponsor who has actually a valuable message. So today's Big Web Show is sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? If every business needs great people and a better way to find them, something better than just posting your job online and praying the right people see it. ZipRecruiter knew there was a smarter way, so they built a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. These invitations have revolutionized how you find your next hire. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applications you receive so you never miss a great match. The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. Businesses of all size trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. And right now, Big Web Show listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, you can try it for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. One more time, ZipRecruiter.com/bigwebshow to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And we're back with Kevin Hoffman, Man About Town, Gadfly, Warrior, Dad, board member of IA Summit and Interaction Design Conference, speaker, facilitator, founder, author. So you were, you know what, we never finished. You mentioned, Kevin, this is a book like 7 years in the making. I saw you in these rooms 7 years ago. I said, wow, this, and then you wrote an article. I said, you've got to write about this. You wrote this article for List Apart. You gave talks, and the talks were so about making sense of meetings, and the talks were so great. I said, I think there's a book here. I think one of the reasons, I was nervous about the book was that it was a very collaborative project for you. Talk about that. How did you write this particular book?
Oh, I love that you asked that question, because that's like, it was such a process of learning about myself. So I talked to you and the awesome team you have at A Book Apart. I talked to a few other companies, and I ended up deciding to work with Rosenfeld Media and Lou Rosenfeld's team for a couple of different reasons. But one of them was I said, look, I'm a first-time author. I have not written a book before, and I want to learn about how to do this in the process of doing it, which is something that nobody wants to hear when you hire them, right?
Right.
Like, nobody wants to hear, hey, you know, you're going to hire me. We're going to go into a contract, and I'm going to do this job for you, but I want to learn about how to do the job while I'm doing it.
Except that is what we do when we take on design projects. When we do UX, that is exactly what we do when we're doing it.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know anything. I do have some assumptions about your business. I'm going to ignore those because that's bias and that's probably wrong. And I do want to hear what you know, because that's important institutional alert. But I really want to do research, because I want to have a beginner's mind and approach this like I don't know anything and figure out what you need. I want to really ask questions like a three-year-old.
Right. And as a first-time writer of a book, you know, I did really kind of feel like a three-year-old in the field, and there was some level of freedom and ability to course correct and ability to explore that I wanted to make sure I had to ultimately write something that got the message across in a way that I intended.
And I knew that Lou Rosenfeld would be very supportive of it and would love the idea. I remember saying to you, Lou will love this.
Yeah. And Lou and I,
because it's UX idea. I want to write this book the way I approach a project, instead of I'm the author. I know what I'm doing. I've got 5 sample chapters here. I need some help restructuring my outline and I can make these dates. You're not doing that at all.
Yeah. And to Lou's credit, I think he really provided me with a team that allowed me to work in a process that was more self-directed, but still accountable. One of the things that I talked about with Lou early on was that, you know, I think that in the space of visualizing your content, thinking about illustrations, both diagrammatic and, you know, drawings, you know, I didn't really have a clear vision for what I wanted to do, but I knew as a designer that I had the most success when I came to an illustrator and said, here's the meaning of the thing, you tell me what it should look like. What does that make you think about as a person who communicates in visuals? And I had the good fortune to work with an illustrator named Matt Sutter, who
know him well.
Yeah, I think he's done work for A List Apart over the years.
He and Kevin Hoffman went to school together with Jason Santa Maria as well.
Cornell?
Kevin Cornell, yes. Yeah. What did I say? Kevin Hoffman.
Kevin Hoffman. Awesome too.
He's awesome, but I'm talking to him. My brain, my gosh.
I talk
to my dad and I go, okay, this is what I have to look forward to. And I love my dad, but I mean, as you get older, your brain starts to do scary things, and my brain just did that.
Oh, don't worry about it.
Okay. Well, I just said Kevin Hoffman.
I would take being confused with Kevin Cornell any day.
Yeah, he's a great, they're both great illustrators. I think they were roommates in school or something.
And
They're part of this crew, a bunch of those guys. Yeah, these just, this talented group of almost like desperados that went to school together and just had a huge impact on our industry.
Yeah, well, but Matt was like, early on, I met with Matt. I was like, do you want to do this? I don't know. Roughly, it might be this many illustrations. I'm not as sure exactly what they will all be. And then as I wrote, as I get like a chapter finished, I would say, here's where I think we could illustrate an interesting idea. This is the basic idea. What do you think it should be? He might do a really rough pencil sketch. And then we'd kind of go back and forth on some things. And I would say, well, you know, here's where I think it's true to the concept. Here's where I think we've gone in a little bit of a tangent. And if that tangent has value, let's go further. If not, let's true back to the original intent. But that collaborative process was wonderful with Matt. And I hope he's really happy with the results.
Did I'm it very help happy you with, it. With the writing, too, as you started to see the illustrations?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like seeing... I've worked with Kevin Cornell and Matt for illustrations for talks and articles and the book. Matt did the whole book, and definitely, like, as soon as I like, there's this one concept I talk about, which is I talk about this idea. Well, I'm just flipping through the book, and there's so many. So there's this concept I talk about where I talk about the cost of a meeting. So, you know, we think about meetings where we multiply the salaries of the people, the hourly rates of those people by the number of hours, by the number of people in the room, and that's how much a meeting costs. In addition to all the time it takes to get ready and the time it takes to recover and code switch into another topic after the meeting.
Right.
So I was like, how do we illustrate that? And Matt, I think, came up with this idea of plumbers. So imagine that you're in a basement and you're a team of plumbers, and the water is leaking into the basement, right? And instead of like acting, the plumbers choose to sit down and actually have a meeting around, well, how do we best solve this problem? And he drew this illustration. It's on page 57 of, like, there's three plumbers around a pipe, and the pipe is spewing water. And one plumber is saying crescent wrench, and another plumber is saying joint, and the third plumber is saying plunger. And they're all just looking at the thing. One of them's eating his lunch, and the basement's filling up with water. And when he said that, to illustrate like the cost associated with meetings, I took that metaphor and brought it into the text, right? Because it was a really fun, powerful way to think about, you know, how meetings are hemorrhaging money, you know, so if they're not used effectively.
When I was in advertising, I entered advertising after the obviously after the creative revolution of the 60s, which was Bill Birnbach saying, it used to be there'd be the madman, the copywriter.
Yeah.
Would go off, drink his scotch, be brilliant, write some cute headlines, and then walk them down the hall to the art director who would make it look pretty. Mm-hmm. And that was the old way. And Birnbach said, that's terrible. You need this team. And he put art director and writer together, and maybe the writer thought of the visual. Maybe the art director thought of some of the copy. The words, the copy would take would be changed because of the visual. And I think good design always works that way. I mean, for me, when I write to the layout. I write a different way for List Apart than I write for Medium.
Right.
Even though they're not that different of layouts, but I write differently because I know how the words are going to look. When I wrote books, I had to use the typeface my book was going to be set in. Yeah. I remember I got new writers who were my first publisher. I said, I can't. Everybody else was using this sort of like Courier or something to some monospaced font because it made it easier to estimate word count and character count and page count. And I got that. I got why that was useful. But I said, I can't write. I can't write in a monospaced font. And I know that sounds like precious and snowflakey and everything, but I really felt like nothing was flowing. I needed, but if I saw it in the actual emigre font that I was had decided was how the book was going to be set, I was, the words flowed.
Yeah. There's something you said that I think is really interesting that hasn't occurred to me before. And I want to share this with you and see how it sits with you. So you talked about the advertising boom, Mad Men, Madison Avenue, and how there was this fundamental realization that a pass it over the wall process where we take copy, we develop the copy, we pitch it to the client. The client says, "What, great." It goes to the illustrator. The illustrator is stuck with that copy and they make an illustration. There was a realization that if we allow our domains of expertise to inform each other in real time, we get to things that we can't get to otherwise. Yep. So then look at the history of web design. Look at you and me when we were working together. Oh God, maybe 10 years ago, I'm going to guess.
When I've been in control, it's never been a siloed thing. It's always been a collaborative thing because I had that ad experience.
Yeah.
And because I didn't know whether I was a designer, a writer, or a coder. And I still don't know. What I've realized is I'm kind of mediocre at all those things. And I find people who are better than me at each of them. And that's my skill. But,
but here's the thing. Let's look at web design. There's the history of, there's a history of practices. And information architecture is a practice manifesting in many things, but among them, sitemaps, and sitemaps being passed over
to the designer,
to a designer who then renders them. And we realized at some point, and maybe we were doing it when I started working with you already, that by having our practices inform each other, that there's places we can go and problems we can solve in ways that we haven't solved them before, either more efficiently, cost-wise, or more creatively in terms of our own creative fulfillment with our work.
Whenever the budget allows, bring as many people to the meeting as possible. The opposite of meetings suck, let's not bother people. It's like not just, the back-end coder's a genius. Let her be, leave her alone, just let her code. No, she's a genius. Bring her to the meeting.
Yeah,
exactly. She's going to listen to this thing we're trying to achieve, and she'll say,
Yeah, she's going to see a constraint that we don't see. She's going to see an opportunity we don't see.
Exactly. So
the thing I think we learn from those two examples and from lots of other examples in lots of other industries is that as a collective, there are things that are possible if we start thinking in terms of we and we think less in terms of I. That historically, in both of those examples, and there's many others in business, I believe, where by looking at our process as a collective and thinking about how things are distributed and how we share ideas, that we're able to make gains and innovate in ways that we cannot do working in a siloed, hand-over-work fashion. So then here's the thing that I think is the most important thing to take from that. If we assume that the connections are where the potential lies, there is never an endeavor where meetings aren't a part of that. There is never a thing we're going to do where we're going to get the best value, the best ideas, the most efficient process, whatever it is we're trying to get, where meetings aren't a part of that. Because unless you're Prince, rest in peace, unless you're Prince, you can't do it all by yourself same way you can do it in a band.
Good golly. I've been listening to him almost nonstop for the last 2 days for some reason. Because I always, if I go off him for a while and then I go back, I hear completely different things.
But the thing about Prince, even Prince, as a soloist.
He kept on having groups like the Revolution.
There was always, Prince understood the value of a team and how to build a team. Steve Jobs understood the value of a team and how to build a team.
He was this figurehead, but it was purely the team. He would just yell at them, like, work harder or something.
The Clash
is better than Joe Strummer. I love Joe Strummer. I love Joe Strummer in The Clash more than I love Joe Strummer's solo career. Talking Heads are better than David Byrne and Tom Tom Club. No offense to those people, but, John Lennon isn't the same as the Beatles. right? And Paul McCartney is certainly not the same as the Beatles. And whatever genre of music you want to go to, I mean, in most cases, unless they're that incredibly rare genius like Prince, the product is better with the band. And as you just said, even Prince, although he could play everything and often made some great albums that way, he would stand in the background sometimes.
Yeah. And to bring it to life, like when you saw Prince, I never saw him in concert, but I saw him live on television many times.
And, yeah.
You know, when you bring it to life, like I think about late era Prince and the way his band, both visually and aurally, presented itself, and the tight kind of funk power that they had, that's not possible as an individual. That's a thing you create as a group. It doesn't exist without the group. There's no way that happens without that group going through the process of figuring out where the sweet spots are. And that's what meetings are. I mean, I don't want to.
Funk is a great example because, I mean, even think of like the greatest funk bass player in the world. You could listen to them soloing for a couple minutes and it would be awesome, but it's not the same. It's not the same as like the power of when you get these musicians playing together. Music, I had a music background too, so maybe that's another reason.
Both and of us.
The bands were always more capable than the individuals
on their own. So that, you know, let's say Bootsy Collins, we're talking about, you know, as an example of like the funkiest bass player ever.
Right.
He goes into a solo. Out of context, it's so boring, right?
Yes.
Like a bass solo by itself, if you watch any heavy metal band from the 80s and you see these like self-indulgent, the solo begins and ends out of the context of a song. But in the context of a song, when a group is making a thing and then you create space for someone to shine and kind of sit within but above the conversation musically or in a meeting, then it's like, it actually gives meaning to the solo.
Miles Davis plays three long notes.
Yeah.
Instead of he started with bebop. He could play anything super fast. He could have been like the heavy metal or the Emerson, Lake and Palmer type show off musician. But he went from there to being this weird sound sculptor where he just make three little wailing notes. And if you just heard the notes with nothing else, it would be a completely different thing. But he did those while the band was creating this incredible kinetic energy. And then he was just sort of this sculptor, this light sculptor on top of that. Anyway, we're going in a way far from meetings. Certainly, I don't think I'm ever going to be in a meeting as exciting as watching Miles Davis in concert. But
I think that's the goal, man. That's the goal.
Fair enough. But because when you have an idea, when a team is cooking, it is really powerful. It is really exciting.
I love, one of the things I get to do in my job right now is that I am not really responsible for making things happen. I am responsible for creating an ecosystem in which things can happen. I am responsible for making sure that the designers are happy, that they are engaged. I am responsible for making sure we have our designers organized in ways that suit each other. I'm responsible for making sure that ultimately the quality of their work is to the level that it needs to be. But, you know, I support a team of 85 people. So I'm designing a world for them to do great design.
You're Walt Disney.
Sure. Maybe.
I'm with you. At a certain point, he stopped animating pretty early on, but he created an environment where other animators could do their best work.
Yeah. So here's the thing that I love about that. One of the meetings that I try to design is or that I do design is our all hands meeting. So as a team of 85 people, once a quarter, we try to get together in person figure out what we want to change about our organization. What are we making? And a lot of what we try to make in those kinds of meetings is a culture. We're trying to make a culture where people feel validated. People feel like they matter. and people feel like they can find a fulfilling design career in the context of the work that we have for them to do in this organization. One of the things that I introduced that I'm really proud of is we introduced this lightning talk approach to sharing. So every time we do one of these big meetings, we come up with a topic, and the topics are driven by a larger editorial arc. And we try to come up with a topic that we say, hey, if you want to talk about this topic for 5 minutes, you could do anything you want. But, you know, work with somebody to help coach your story and develop a presentation, and then do a 5-minute lightning talk. And every time I've done this, and I've done it twice now in the last, I've been there for 7 months, so 2 quarters. Every time I've done this, there is somebody who I have no expectations. You know, I want everybody to be great, but there's always a couple of people who it's like out of the blue, they deliver this amazing insight or this amazing experience or this hilarious story. And, you know, in a team of 85 people, I'm really proud that I can hopefully remember everybody's name and what they do and what they're good at. But when you really give the opportunity for somebody to shine and really be recognized amongst their peers, that changes everything about the work. Because the next time they're working on a tough project, the next time they're trying to solve a tough problem, they're going to think about that person in a different way.
Yes.
That person's going to come into their mind as that's a person who took this concept. The last time we did it was about personal failures, who took this concept of personal failure and learned from it and made meaning from it and made humor from it. And that's what we need for this work right now. And that's something that I feel really privileged to be able to do in my work is to create opportunities and openings for people to play that bass solo, so to speak.
Are you hiring right now?
We're always sort of hiring. I would say We probably have between 2 and 5 open positions that we're looking to fill. But I know of 2 or 3 more positions that, depending on how things evolve, we'll probably, you know, need to fill them.
I can tell you, Capital One, I mentor people and I teach at School of Visual Arts, and I can't tell you how many people are interested in working at Capital One now because of the culture you and others are creating there, which is something that wouldn't have happened 2 years ago.
Yeah, you know? I feel really fortunate to be there. I want to be really crystal clear. I've only been there for a couple of quarters, and there are people who were there long before me that created a wonderful culture.
Yep.
Probably going well back into the realization that design needed to be at the table in terms of reporting up to the CEO, you know, not just being buried in a line of business.
But they're actually doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of companies, we both know of companies that talk about design, and it becomes you know how people say, like, we're environmentally conscious, but they're not, and they do some whitewashing thing to try to look like they're but they're not. Design is sort of another thing like that, another little badge that sometimes companies think, oh, we've got to be in favor. We're in favor of design. Why? We have all these people on staff, and it's like, we don't give them an environment in which they can see, we can succeed. We don't give them direction. We don't take direction from them. So yes, you've added a lot of people to the payroll, but they don't know what they're doing, and you don't know what you're doing with them.
I think fundamentally, if they think about design as the end result, like I'm looking at the finished screens, that's design. Then they're not really thinking about design.
Right.
They're thinking about polish. They're thinking about UI. But if you think about design as a process, if you think about design as the disambiguation of problems and the exploration of possibility, then that is, you know, where organizations actually create good design cultures.
Design is not the end result. Kevin Hoffman, this has been The Big Web Show with Kevin Hoffman, author of Meeting Design. This I want to end it there because that was fantastic. Also, we're at 60 minutes. Minutes, but
it was my pleasure.
That was a fantastic way to end. Always a pleasure to talk to you. You're just such a bright guy and so positive.
Oh, thank you.
And I wish you great tremendous success with the book. I have a copy. I can't wait to tear into it. I just got it last night. Yeah. I'll be reading it on my way to Seattle this week.
Oh, cool. Have a great conference in Seattle.
Thank you. Thank you. And I will see you soon and hopefully get you back on the show soon.
Yeah. Anytime you want me back, just say the word. I would pay to talk to you if I had to.
I would pay to talk to you as well. Take care.
All right, Jeffrey. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.